and Natural Resources, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2118A. This DQ, whoever would like to come up.
Madam Chair, just to preface, you have at your place a packet of material for all three of the bills. For 2118, you have a copy of the fiscal impact statement on the -A5 amendments. You have a copy of the -A5 amendments, and then the staff measure summary from the House Committee from which the bill came.
Thank you. We had 2 days of hearings on 2118. Thank you, Tim. Let's go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Neil Mullane, and I manage the Water Quality Permits Program for DEQ's Northwest Region. I'm here today to support House Bill 2118. 2118 allows the department to undertake the actions necessary to implement the Underground Injection Control Program in the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the bill specifically allows us to establish a fee schedule whereby we can assess fees for the activities to be conducted. The fees would be placed into an account that we would draw from for the activities to administer the program. Now, the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act requires the protection of drinking water across the nation. And the UIC program was established specifically to regulate the activities that would impact the groundwater in terms of drinking water. And Oregonians rely upon groundwater as a fresh supply of healthy drinking water, and about half the state relies upon groundwater as its primary source of drinking water. And unlike surface water, groundwater is not always treated prior to use. So it's important for us to really look at how we can protect groundwater so people can have an uncontaminated source of drinking water. The injection systems that we're talking about today are really designed to place wastewater and stormwater below the surface so that it can infiltrate into the ground and consequently infiltrate into the groundwater. And what we're looking at in this program is really fees to review the injection well applications to make a determination as to whether or not they can be authorized under the department's rules. And we've worked with the major stakeholder groups who use these injection systems and worked with them on this fee program. And basically, the fees would increase as the environmental risk increases in this program. And as we look at more complex situations and authorizations, we would need additional funds to do those type of activities. In the program, we've basically divided it into three categories: simple situations, moderate situations, and complex situations. And if you look at this, we're looking basically for the simple type of UICs, is where stormwater is coming off of roofs and we're injecting that stormwater into the ground. In a moderate situation, we're looking at stormwater that may be coming off of industrial or commercial facilities that don't handle hazardous materials. And we're looking at private situations where we have less than 50 wells. And if you're looking at streets and commercial parking lots, we're looking at those particular commercial parking lots that have less than 1,000 vehicle trips per day. Now, under the complex UIC situations, we're looking at facilities that actually handle hazardous materials, and also situations where we have more than 50 wells, 50 or more wells at a particular site, and also where we would have parking lots or traffic volumes that would be over 1,000 trips per day. Now, the fees that are proposed in the bill would be to place about a $100 fee for the simple category, $125 for the moderate category, and $300 for the complex category. And in addition, in the bill, we have identified for geothermal, and that would be for high-temperature energy production type of facilities, a fee of $10,000 per UIC. And in these situations, we're looking at basically the large geothermal activities that would be like at the Newberg volcanic area, where we would be actually going into a production for the geothermal facility. We've looked over the data for the last 4 years in the department in terms of the number of these activities that have come into the department and averaged those out. And just to give you an idea, that over the last 4 years, the average is about 400 simple requests for rule authorizations for injection wells, about 2,200 for moderate injection wells, and about 500 for complex. So as you go through the math on the fees that we're requesting and those basic numbers, we would be looking at basically $1.3 million per biennium for this under this program. Before I close, I would also like to mention that we have looked at the amendments to the bill, and we are okay with the amendments to the bill. And I'd also like to say that John Ledger came up to me before we came up here and said that they are in support of the bill. And with that, I'd like to close and would be more than willing to answer any questions.
We'll take a question from Representative Garrard, and then I have a quick question for you about the amendments.
Thank you.
Representative, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Down in my neck of the woods in Klamath Falls, Oregon Institute of Technology is on the brink of becoming the first university solely heated by geothermal process. This is going to incur a $10,000 license fee on them?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, the answer to that question is no. If I understand correctly, I believe those wells are already existing and in. Yes.
That was my question. Somewhere in here, it sort of talks about only going forward, new applications for wells, anything existing, period, anywhere is grandfathered.
Madam Chair, Representative, the intent of the program, it really is to focus on the new situations where we would be receiving applications. The department does have applications on hand that we haven't worked through yet, and we would be working through those applications under this program at a rate of about 2 to 3% a year on that backlog that we already have. But in addition to that, no, we would not be going back and looking at other situations.
Follow-up.
Unless it's a decommissioning, it looks like in line E on page 2, where there's something existing that they want to decommission, then that is a new fee of $100.
That is correct.
Okay. Just a quick question about the amendments, because we did also amend the bill in my policy committee. Could you, I just want to clarify, I think Representative Burley had a constituent that identified a typo, basically, that we missed. So maybe you can just comment on that, and that's on line 3 of the amendment. And then also, could you say what these amendments actually do and how they change the bill, since we didn't discuss this in our policy committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. The amendment that I have, the egg engrossed...
Dash 5, sorry.
Excuse me. We were looking at the on page 1 to delete in line 2 the reference to the statute, ORS 468-135. And the second is on the second page of the bill on line 7. There was essentially we have in the bill 1,000 trips per year, and the amendment would change that to 1,000 trips per day. And that was just an oversight in drafting the bill. We have always developed the fee categories and tables with 1,000 trips per day, and it was an oversight on our part. The next amendment that we have is on the same page, on lines 35 through 44, the original section 6 of the bill would be deleted, and the department is in favor of that. And the final change would be to change the section 7, to section 6.
So it's just a renumbering on there.
Renumbering
that. Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. Why don't you go ahead and ask if there's additional questions.
I'm Rodney Weick with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, hydrogeologist in our Northwest Region office. I'm here in support of the bill and its amendments and here to answer questions.
I just want to make sure everyone knows what a UIC is, because we had a lot of discussion about what, if you're familiar, a lot of them are actually sumps. It's just the non-technical word. So we had a lot of discussion about what they were in the committee, but I think that's a very important bill. Senator?
Yes, thank you. You have 45,000 injection systems registered and likely an unequal amount, and then you have the simple, complex, and moderate. Do you have a breakdown of, I mean, how many of these are simple, how many are moderate, how many are complex? The end part of that is, how does it affect, like, the local homeowner maybe has his roof, switching the water off the roof system? How is this going to affect him?
Madam Vice Chair, Senator Nelson, when it comes to the individual family homeowners that are looking at roof drains, we've effectively exempted that and that would be addressed through the rules in that to codify that.
Thank you. Gentlemen, if there's other questions, we'll pull up the other witnesses. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up Shannon Taylor from the City of Redmond and Barb Atkins from the City of Gresham. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Shannon Taylor, and this is Barb Atkins. First, before I get started, we're handing out some packets with some letters of support and also an article that was in the Bend Bulletin, and there's a very good kind of drawing of what one example of an underground injection control system, which is a dry well. There's a graphic which kind of shows what that is. So this pipe here would be connected to a catch basin in the street. Again, for the record, my name is Shannon Taylor. This is Barb Atkins, and we are pleased to represent the Groundwater Protection Coalition here today. The coalition consists of the cities of Bend, Eugene, Gresham, Milwaukee, Portland, and Redmond, Clackamas and Multnomah counties, and TriMet, all of which utilize underground injection control devices for the disposal of stormwater. The coalition was established to ensure that the protection of Oregon's groundwater remain at the state level through proper funding of Oregon's DEQ underground injection control program. It's essential to the coalition that the proposed funding adequately provide for increased DEQ service levels required by our representative communities. The coalition supports House Bill 2118, the Groundwater Protection Act of 2007, and its proposed amendments. We feel it's important for DEQ to retain the UIC program to facilitate development and allow developers to select proven and cost-effective options while still protecting groundwater quality. Coalition members feel that these interests are best served by a state-administered program. Proper state funding will allow for timely development reviews, development of guidance documents, technical assistance and permit processing, and issuance by staff with knowledge of local issues. This will benefit both local agencies and the development community. With DEQ retaining the program, it will allow us to work with DEQ to improve the current UIC rules and to consider innovative technologies for stormwater and treated wastewater effluent.
Barb. And can you state your name again for the record, please?
Madam Vice Chair Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, my name is Barbara Atkins, and I also represent the Groundwater Protection Coalition. The coalition has worked extensively to prevent the return of the UIC program to EPA by working with DEQ to formulate the fee table proposed in the amendments to House Bill 2118. Under the proposed structure, DEQ will charge fees to rule authorize, permit, or decommission UIC systems. The coalition feels that the proposed fees are fair, reasonable, and easy to implement and will adequately fund the program and increase the levels of service provided by DEQ to our agencies and the development community. The coalition supports all proposed amendments being considered for this bill. If House Bill 2118 is not passed, DEQ will return the program, the UIC program, to EPA. It's our concern that EPA administration would result in an enforcement-only program, cause significant delays for development projects, and potentially cause economic impacts for some communities. Under EPA administration, it will likely place agencies in a position of increased regulatory uncertainty and potential for increased liability of third-party lawsuits. The state protection of Oregon's groundwater and drinking water source is vital for the continued protection of our aquifers. We, the members of the Groundwater Protection Coalition, urge you to pass House Bill 2118 and keep the future of Oregon's groundwater in local hands. Thank you very much for your time, and Shannon and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Gerard,
we have a list of the cities, entities that are in support of that. Is there anyone in opposition?
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Garrard, to our knowledge, we haven't heard any opposition. In fact, we've heard to the contrary. Even I've had developers say, you know, I would pay $1,000 to have this through today. I think actually they said $10,000 at the time.
Representative,
I'll get them in here.
Yeah, raise that. The Oregon Home Builders Association will be testifying after this, but nobody testified in opposition in my policy committee. Yeah. Any other questions, Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. How can a backlog or delay in the issuance of these permits affect the operations of the city or the development itself inside the urban growth boundary?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, it affects different communities different ways. There's several cities that have applied for area-wide permits for their UIC system. So they have, in Redmond's case, we have about 1,500 devices. And so we've applied for an area-wide permit for that. And until we're issued that permit, DEQ is required to do, on a case-by-case basis, rule authorization for those systems. And so we have said, you know, you're not allowed to develop your property unless you receive rule authorization. At this time, there's no general permits for devices, so they have to meet the intent of the rule or they cannot build them. And it has to be done before they can construct. So any right-of-way UIC that's built in the city of Redmond that's new is at the 90-day backlog before the review is done and they're allowed to construct. So that's an example in Redmond, but different communities are handling it different ways.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, ladies. Appreciate you coming over again. Okay, next we have Ken Fuller from the City of Bend and Lisa Libby from the City of Portland.
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Libby, and I am here to provide written testimony on behalf of Portland City Commissioner Sam Adams. Unfortunately, City Commissioner Sam Adams is unable to attend today, but he does urge your support of House Bill 2118, the Groundwater Protection Act of 2007. Underground injection control structures are critical for implementation of the sustainable development strategies that we're urging in Portland because it reduces the need for piped infrastructure, which keeps this valuable resource out of the sewer system. As you're aware, in Portland, groundwater is a backup drinking water supply source for us, and the permit that we've been able to establish with DEQ allows the city to construct, operate, and maintain UICs to protect groundwater. House Bill 2118 has broad stakeholder support, and we see it as providing a fair funding mechanism for protection of the state's critical groundwater resources. So on behalf of the City of Portland, we urge you to pass this important legislation today.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Ken Fuller. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Bend. And I'm here to ask for your support of HB 2118. As most of you know, the City of Bend relies heavily on groundwater, and we've won many awards for our groundwater and water supply over the last several years. And protecting this groundwater source is one of our highest priorities for our citizens and our utilities. Because of our unique location, most of our stormwater within the city is injected into the ground, and we feel that the DEQ is the appropriate administrators of the UIC program, and our support to this is really to keep it into the state's hands and not allow this to move over into EPA hands. So I want to leave it at that and open up any questions.
Coming over here today as well. Any questions?
Yeah, I'll ask one.
Sure. Your city, I think.
Our award-winning water, is that fluoridated?
Technically it is, but it's naturally.
My guess. I don't know if it was quite germane to this bill, but any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And we, once again, I'm calling up in tandem Lindsay Capps and John Chandler.
Chandler intends to sing. I advise you.
He intends to what? Sing?
He indicated he was going to sing this morning.
Who, Lindsay or John?
John.
You can make a comment, but I'll be kind. Last time they had a chair in between them.
Stop moving like this.
Yes. They do this. They go around signing up together. You start with John likes to have the last word, so we'll let him have it.
Reputation and chatter. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lindsay Capps, Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council, here today to express our strong support for HB 2118. And I know this may not be the most charismatic issue that you have to deal with, but we do believe this bill is very important in terms of protecting public health and the environment. There are thousands of UICs around the state where stormwater is sent directly into the ground, and there's the potential for groundwater contamination and, by extension, drinking water contamination if these UICs aren't properly designed, installed, or maintained. And so we would obviously support having the capacity at DEQ to work on this issue. Right now, I think there's less than one full-time staff person dealing with, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,500 permits per year. And it's much better to have local technical assistance and guidance than sort of outside arbitrary complaint-based enforcement from the EPA. I think that's an important principle from a sound environmental management standpoint. We also think there needs to be more clarity in terms of the rules regarding UICs. There are other technologies that can be more cost-effective, such as bioswales and other stormwater management techniques that we believe DEQ has the capacity to work on this, can look into at more depth. So for those reasons, we support the bill and thank the committee for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, also here in support of House Bill 2118. When this issue first surfaced at DEQ, that they had 0.85 FTE statewide, and as a result, they weren't doing a very good job and thought they ought to just give the whole program back to the feds. That sent a wave of panic over my membership. We use dry wells or UICs a lot, and depending on the jurisdiction, it's a very cost-effective and oftentimes the most effective environmental way to handle stormwater. And to have the EPA involved as opposed to a state agency struck us as a remarkably bad idea. We're going to be paying a lot of the fees that are in this package in front of you, and I won't say we're happy to do that because we wouldn't buy that, but we're certainly willing to, and we think that it's a good program. I also want to say for the record, we really appreciate DEQ's efforts on this, bringing industry, environmental groups, municipalities together to talk about how best to proceed as opposed to coming with an idea and letting us chase it. It was a good process. We're looking forward to working with them in the future.
Thank you. Any questions for John and Lindsay?
We know better.
Thank you, gentlemen. Okay. Anybody else would like to testify in this bill? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing.
No, please. Could I have the DEQ?
Certainly. I'll reopen the public hearing and ask DEQ to come up, or I could open a work session as well.
That's okay.
Madam Chair, the fiscal analysis that we have in front of us would indicate that your revenues are going to exceed the expenditures by some $360,000 a year. I'm just wondering, and it says down here that you will continually appropriate funds to DEQ to pay administrative expenses. But if the expenses still aren't coming close to the revenues, and you've got that much profit, in essence, every year, maybe the fees are too high.
Madam Chair, Representative Girard, and I'll have Rodney also address this question. I wasn't aware that there was an expression of the fee revenue being that high. As we were walking through this, we were trying to match the fees pretty closely to the FDE that we had, knowing that we would in fact have some additional resources that would be carried over time. And the intent, obviously, from our perspective, was that instead of coming back and changing fees on a routine, you know, annual or biannual basis, that we would have some revenue there. Then as the program expenses build over time, we would eat into that, any of the carryover that we'd have from the fees generated. And at a point in the future, and we were projecting out originally, I believe it was about 6 to 8 years in the future, that there would be a crossover. We would, in fact, have not the revenue from the fees to support the positions, and we would have to then, at that point in time, increase the fees. And I think that's the way the fee-generated tables that we have.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I might just point out, too, that the one of the things that we do with the fiscal impact statement form is for the out biennium, we don't include any kind of estimates of inflation or additional costs. So you just see the same expenditures for 07-09. We just use for 09-11. Now, realistically, those are going to go up. We know that they'll be higher than they were this biennium. They always go up as personnel costs go up, inflation adjustments are made. So it's very, it's not unusual at all to set the fees at a higher level, as DEQ represented, so that you're not coming back every 2 years to adjust fees. So you build up some balance. You get to a point about halfway through where you're about even, and then you start spending down that balance. When you start spending down the balance, you come back for another fee increase and start the cycle again.
Chair, I guess my discussion is, Paul, is it normally 25%?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, I mean, that is, it's a little high. I would also note that we're working on the revenue estimates with the department. We got some revenue information from them yesterday, pretty late, and haven't had a chance to really vet it yet. But I think that it's intended to raise more revenue than they spend at the beginning. That's the intent. There's no question about that. And then that they would be spending down that balance over time.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? Actually, first of all, I want to see if you two agree with the analysis Paul just gave, just so we can hear it from the agency's mouth. And then second, if that is the case, talk a little bit about the necessity to have that money available over time as opposed to coming back later when you need it.
Madam Vice Chair, Senator, when we were working with the stakeholders in developing this fee package, it was one of the items that we discussed on this. In fact, the fees that are proposed in this package are considerably lower than what we had originally started with in those discussions. We agree with the staff's analysis on the intent was that we would effectively be building up a reserve. In our projections and carrying this out, part of our analysis actually looked out, tried to forecast out 16 years ahead to take a look at what are we looking at, how best to handle this program and manage it. And the crossover of increasing staff costs, inflation, et cetera, versus the fees came out about 6 to 8 years out in projection to where exceeding the cost to run the program would be exceeding the fees to come in. And at that time, about the six-year mark, as we discussed in our many committee meetings, this would be when we would look at revisiting the staffing that we have, what we're doing, do we need to tweak the program to keep the fees the same, has the amount of applications increased or are they decreasing? How is the industry going with that with respect to the program? And then work with stakeholders before coming back to see if we really needed an increase in fees at that time.
Well, sort of. Let's just make sure that our understanding is correct. You want enough money out of this so that you can have stability in your program for 6 years until you get to the point where you cross that threshold like you're talking about, and that is a better way for you to manage this program than having to come back to the legislature every 2 years to adjust the fee to keep up with your costs. Is that a fair statement?
Madam Vice Chair, Senator, yes, that is correct.
Representative Garrard.
Maybe it's just my naivety, but I just can't buy that. I think you start off with a lower fee, and begin to run the program and then come back to the legislature and take a look at whether your fees are adequate or not. And I could even live with something around 5 to 10%, but 25% to me is, I think those fees are just too high.
I have a question for you regarding the interaction with the stakeholder group. There was discussion about these particular fees.
Madam Chair, yes, there was.
And was there agreement that for the stakeholders who are paying these fees to make sure that the program was not handed back to EPA and that it was properly implemented, including the backlog, and there was agreement that these fees were acceptable?
Madam Chair, yes. We worked with stakeholder groups for several months, and we worked on different fee amounts, and this was the fee amount everybody agreed with.
And this, just to follow up to that, this would cover your backlog, because part of what I've heard both in the policy discussions in my committee and then here is just a huge amount of backlog that is, let's say, for many of the cities that we just heard from, they're unable to process their permits, their development permits, and move forward without the UIC permits being processed and approved.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We have a number of cities that have submitted permit applications to us that we have had on hold for a number of years that we haven't been able to get to. And of the 45,000 wells in the state, about 19,000 of them we have registered, but we haven't been able to move through and take care of the rule authorization for those wells. And the fee here builds in work on those backlog permits and backlogged rule authorization activities.
I just want to make a comment with respect to the testimony to complement what Representative Gerard's comment was, and that's that in my opinion, it's refreshing to see both this body and the executive branch building a budget that creates stability for a program over a number of biennia, as opposed to having to hop from each biennial budget just to have programs survive. And I think that's good for the public, and I think it's good for efficient workings of your agency, both. So I'm fully supportive of the increase based on that testimony.
And I applaud the department for your hard work, because I know that you worked diligently with stakeholders to make sure that there was a consensus on this approach, and I appreciate that. We don't always see that. Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, just a comment. Because we don't have any testimony from the taxpayers, who are the ones that are winding up paying this, so I just don't feel comfortable with it.
Thank you, gentlemen. Anybody else like to testify? Public hearing. Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2118A and open up a work session on House Bill 2118A. Entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, LFO is recommending adoption of the A5 amendments to House Bill 2118.
Okay.
So moved.
Okay. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll be voting no.
Okay. Representative Gerard, voting no. Any other discussion? Okay. With that, the motion carries and the dash fives are amended.
And then, Madam Chair, LFO is recommending approval of House Bill 2118 as amended to the full committee.
Okay.
So moved.
There's a motion to adopt or forward House Bill 2118 with the due pass recommendation as amended with the dash fives to the full Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Representative Burley?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Though I agree with my good friend and colleague, Representative Gerard, I share the same concerns about the revenue and expenses. At the same time, I will support this in subcommittee because two of my principal concerns during the hearings on this was, A, the stakeholders agreed to this, and they're the ones that write the checks. B, and perhaps even more importantly in this case, is any time we can avoid turning programs like this back over to the federal government is a very high priority for me, because I think most people would agree if they're going to be regulated, they'd rather be regulated by the state than by the federal EPA. So I'll support this.
Thank you for your comments. Representative Moore?
Just that I'll be voting.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Aye.
Senator Ibakin?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye. Motion carries, and the bill will move to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. We need a couple of carriers, and I was going to ask Senator Nelson if you would carry this to the Full Ways and Means and the Senate floor, and then Representative Burley. Since two of your cities are here, would you carry this to the House floor? So it's noted that Representative Burley will carry the bill to the House floor. Okay, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2118A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 104A, underground storage tanks. Paul, can you give us a description?
Madam Chair, again, you have a packet at your place. It has a fiscal impact statement for Senate Bill 104. This deals with fees for the underground storage tank program and also a staff measure summary from the Policy Committee.
I have a feeling DEQ is going to be coming up on this one as well to introduce the bill. We have Al Tippett. Welcome this morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Kippett. I'm the Land Quality Administrator for DEQ, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 104A for the Underground Storage Tank Program for DEQ. I should point out a couple of things. I've got written testimony and a fact sheet that's being passed out to you. Also a copy of a letter of support from EPA for this program. But I'm not going to read my testimony. I'm going to summarize some of the key points of that and then be available for questions. I think a couple of the main factors, the important features of this bill are that it's absolutely critical for the state of Oregon to maintain primacy in running this program. We've been running the underground storage program for many years now. The fee increases that are proposed here from $85 to $135 per tank per year are basically rolling up the cost that we've accrued since 2001, which was the last time we had a fee increase in this program. We have over 1,900 facilities in the state of Oregon with almost 6,000 tanks, underground storage tanks, that are regulated. We've got support for 104A as written by the Oregon Petroleum Association. This may appear to be a fairly large fee increase, but I'll point out, as indicated in the letter from EPA, the state of Washington just increased their tank fees from $100 to $160 per year. So it's not an unreasonable increase. The other thing that's very important is it's allowed us to leverage money from EPA. We've made a commitment to the Petroleum Association that over the past few years to do inspections at facilities once every 5 years. The Energy Policy Act that was recently passed at the national level just required us to do inspections one every 3 years. We did not go to the Oregon businesses and say, you need to help pay for that increase in inspection rate. We said we're going to maintain the fees at a level to do one in five. We'll hit up EPA to cover the difference to get us to one in three. So I think it's a balanced bill and necessary, as I said, to run this program. Another key feature is we've had an expedited enforcement pilot project for the last couple of years where we issue field tickets for violations at underground storage tank facilities. This has been really well received by the regulated community because it's much simpler. They can voluntarily choose to participate in the field ticket program or go through formal enforcement. It's obviously to their advantage and less costly both to them and the department to go through the field ticket program, and our goal is to get in compliance, not to necessarily punish people for mistakes. So there are a number of aspects of this bill that I think are critical to the program. With that, I'll close my testimony and be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank Questions? Representative Klein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we just talking about commercial or residential license
homes? Madam Chair, Representative Klem, this is just for commercial, basically gas stations. The heating oil tank, residential heating oil tank program is a separate program.
That one on the floor.
That's what I thought. Yeah, thank you.
Didn't want to think you were double dipping here.
So,
yeah. No pun intended. Representative Earl.
Does this remove a sunset? And if so, what is the sunset it removes?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, yes, it does. There's basically a sunset that wipes out the fees and the pilot program. So with the sunset in there, the program basically goes away. It was January of 2008. So it does remove the sunset. I should point out, if I could elaborate on that a bit, I think there's been some, I don't know about concern, but some thinking that maybe at some point this program's going to go away. I think we're always going to have some level of maintenance and oversight necessary in this program.
Representative Garrard, and then we'll see if the senators have any questions before we go to Representative Klem.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The bill also increases the penalties. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, yes. For the what we want to do is expand the field ticket program to be more comprehensive. When we initiated it as a pilot program, we just looked at some of the lower-end violations. Now we'd like it to be more comprehensive so that we can deal with a more full spectrum of violations that we typically find in underground storage tanks. So it's not necessarily increasing the penalties for violations we've been looking at in the past as much as it is being more comprehensive in what we can do in the field ticket program.
Representative Klem, you had another question.
I had another question since I thought of that one. Did you have a similar process to like on the last deal where they talked with stakeholder groups and you talked to the gasoline dealers? Are they involved in this?
Madam Chair, Representative Klem, yes, we have very good relationship with the Oregon Petroleum Association and their membership. We talked to them about fee increases. That's why, in fact, this is an engrossed version. When we initially submitted the bill, we did not have fees plugged in. And did that then in the A and Gross version. So we have had extensive conversations with the association and their membership.
My second question, and if I read the fiscal somewhere in here, it says this will go back to the feds just like the last one if we don't do this.
That's correct. This is basically, we aren't adding new positions with this fee increase. We're trying to keep up with inflation since there's been no fee increase since 2001. If the bill doesn't pass, we have no authority, no capability to run the program.
Representative Burley has a question.
I've got a few. One, Madam Chair, I don't know if we have other witnesses.
We don't, actually. That was it. So okay.
Just as a note, in my bill file, and maybe I'm just missing something here, but I've got no record whatsoever of anybody testifying in support of this. Again, it goes back to my litmus test on these types of measures. I see nothing in my file by anybody that's going to write the check saying we're okay with this, A. And B, I want to go back to my earlier question about the sunset. I'm still not quite clear on what is the voluntary program that originally had a sunset on it, and I'm still just not quite sure what the rationale is for removing the sunset.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that sunset on the voluntary program is the field ticket program. We initiated that as a pilot project to see whether or not this was a useful approach in getting compliance with the regulations on underground storage tanks. So we want to remove that sunset so that we can not have any limitations and also make the pilot project, if you will, permanent in our program.
Is there anybody here from the Petroleum Association?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding, I talked to Paul Romaine yesterday. He was not going to be able to be here today, but he said that it was, you know, okay for me to say that OPA is in support of 104A as written.
Representative
Plans. One more follow-up. That field ticket program was the thing that people liked a lot better because they could voluntarily comply somehow rather than more of a sort of regulatory enforcement?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, that's exactly correct. I mean, if previously, before we even tried the pilot project, we have a formal enforcement program. It requires warning letters. They can go through a contested case hearing, but the penalties are usually much higher. This is a much simpler approach, and again, that's why we had it as a pilot project to try it out, where our inspection staff in the field can come to a facility. If they see a violation or two, they can say, okay, here are your options. You can pay $50 for this violation now. You don't get to then contest it. There's no contested case hearing, but we'll work with you to resolve the situation. Or you can opt to go through formal enforcement. And the regulated community has been very supportive of the field ticket program.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. All right, thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 104A, and I will open up a work session on House Bill 104A. And I will entertain a motion. I guess there's no amendments here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee know there are no amendments for Senate Bill 104. I would just also note that there is a package for these fee increase expenditures in Department of Environmental Quality's budget, and that package is part of the co-chair budget.
Okay, thank you. I'll entertain a motion.
No amendments?
No amendments.
I move that we send Senate Bill 104 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, there's a motion to send Senate Bill 104A to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Burley.
Chair, I'll be voting no.
Okay, thank you. Representative Burley. Okay. Ditto for the record. Any other comments? Okay. Motion passes. We'll skip the roll. You guys skip the roll in this committee.
Any other objections?
Any other objections?
None.
Okay. And with that, I will need a carrier to the full.
Well, maybe the chair would like to.
Should we assign the chair?
Yeah.
In absentia, I think.
I will really make you pay then.
I will do it.
No, I'm thinking.
I got my reward.
I think
yes.
The chair of the sun.
Exactly. So Senator Devlin.
Enough gas to get there.
Yes, Senator Devlin.
Senator Devlin.
Will
hear him say he really wants to.
And
there.
Also carry it to the Senate floor, and I will carry it to the House floor. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 104. And last but not least, we have Senate Bill 107, which is emission fees for major sources. I will open up a public hearing. Paul?
Madam Chairman of this committee, you also have a packet at your place for Senate Bill 107. You'll see a fiscal impact statement on the original bill and also a staff measure summary. I would note that the department's been working with the fee payers on a revised schedule for these fees. We brought some amendments down to the Legislative Council, but in the crunch that they're undergoing, they were unable to get them back. We sure appreciate them getting back the amendments on 2118 in time for the hearing, but they were unable because these are fairly complex amendments. So you'll be seeing this bill probably again at a later date, but the department's here, and I believe some others are here to testify on Senate Bill 107. Again, these are fees for the Title V program and major emissions, air emission sources.
Thank you. And I think see Andy Ginsberg, who I saw at 9:30 last night when we were finishing up our hearings. Andy, it's nice to see you again.
Thank you.
I just got a cot outside the Capitol.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for DEQ, and I'm here to provide information and support for Senate Bill 107. And as Paul mentioned, we will have amendments, so we're not ready for you to take action on the bill today, but I would like to describe the amendments and the purpose of the bill. Title V is a title of the Federal Clean Air Act, and it requires all states to have operating permit programs for major emission sources to ensure compliance with air quality regulations. The Oregon legislature adopted the Title V program in 1991. The program is required by federal law to be 100% funded by fees. We're not allowed to use any other type of funding. And the fees are required to be sufficient to cover all the reasonable direct and indirect costs of the program. We have three different kinds of fees in the program. There's an emission fee, which is charged per ton of emissions. And that actually generates 90% of the revenue, so that's the primary fee for the program. There's also a base fee, which is a flat fee per permit, and then there are some minor additional fees for modifications and things like that. Historically, we've had 36 FTE in the program since we've began the program, and they do permitting, inspections, technical assistance, they respond to public inquiries, they do all the administration required. And at that staffing level, we've been able to adequately administer the program. However, we have our revenue has been declining because it's an emission fee. The rate per ton has been the same, but the tons of emissions have been lower, so we've had less emissions. Costs have gone up, and so we've had to reduce staffing. And this last biennium, we dropped 3 FTE, so we're now down at 33 FTE in the program. And for the first time, we're now building up backlogs. We're having trouble keeping up with inspections and permitting, and we have 25% expired permits. So we're kind of on a collision course with a program that's not keeping up with its responsibilities. So without a fee increase, the situation will get worse. In the next biennium, we'll have to cut an additional 1.5 positions, so we'd be down to 31.5 positions. That means we'll have more expired permits, less inspections, and delays for companies if they need to make a change that's not authorized by their permit, and really an inability to meet the public's interest for information about Title V permits. In the long run, we've already heard from EPA about this, and they're concerned about our staffing level. The next step will be they'll conduct an audit, and then in the long run, we could potentially face a loss of program delegation or even a federally administered program. So we conducted a workload analysis to determine how many staff we actually need to run this program. We have done a lot of streamlining, and we considered all of the steps that it takes to issue and inspect a Title V permit and all the streamlining that we've done, and we determined that we can get by with 35 positions instead of 36, so we'd be down one from historical, but up two from where we are today. We then compared ourselves to other states, and we found that we're just about average for similar states in terms of how many permit writers we have per permit. So with that in mind, we submitted Senate Bill 107, which asked for a 24% increase in the Title V fees, and that would be sufficient to cover the cost for 35 positions in the program. In our discussions with stakeholders and permittees, the permittees told us they very much like the way we run the program. They support us maintaining the program and having an adequately funded program, and they're willing to pay higher fees, but they objected to having such a sudden large increase in the fee all at once, and they asked if we could phase the fee increase in over time. And we think that's a reasonable request, and that's why we've submitted some amendments. So when you see the amendments, I'll just describe briefly. The amendments would phase the fee increase in over 3 years. So one-third of the increase would happen each year in 2007, 8, and 9. And then we would also phase the staff in. So in 2007, we would just maintain our current staff rather than dropping by 1.5 positions. And then in 2008, we would add one position. In 2009, we would add the last position. And that would get us back to the level in the workload analysis. It would take a little bit longer, but we think it's a reasonable balancing of all the interests. The amendments do two other important things. One is that they correct a problem that we hadn't anticipated originally in the bill. Under federal law, some of our largest Title V fee payers will soon be installing emission controls and reducing their emissions pretty significantly, and that's a good thing, but there's a side effect of that, which means we'll get less fee revenue for the program. And just because they have lower emissions doesn't mean we'll have lower costs. In fact, our costs will be the same or higher because we'll be having to inspect more sophisticated emission and permit more sophisticated emission control equipment. So to avoid a meltdown in the fees that would revenue for the program that would happen at that time, the amendment increases the base fee to make up for the loss in revenue in 2010. And at the same time, we would revise the cap in the program so that it would be equal to what the emissions would be after they put on these emission controls. So it's a revenue-neutral change for us, but it creates more stability in the program for the long run and prevents us having to come back and ask for another fee increase in a few years. Finally, the amendments do one last thing. They would require us to do more public disclosure when we adopt rules that affect Title V sources. Currently, if we adopt a rule that's more stringent than a federal rule, we already disclose the difference and the reason that we're being different from the federal law. Under the amendment, we would also describe what alternatives we considered and why we rejected the alternatives. And we think more information is good, so we're happy to provide that information. Also, someone affected by the regulation could request a hearing directly in front of the Environmental Quality Commission, which is the body that adopts our rules. Normally, the department holds public hearings, and then we summarize the results for the commission. But in cases where we're going to be more stringent than a federal requirement, if someone felt they were affected by that and wanted to express their views directly to the commission, this amendment would allow them to ask for that. And our commission is very interested in hearing directly from the public on controversial issues, so this is consistent with what they would want. So in summary, Senate Bill 107 would provide funding for 35 positions, one less than historical. The amendments would phase in that increase, and with the amendments, I think you'll hear that all the stakeholders or fee payers are supporting the bill, and it would get us to a point where we could clear up the backlog, and we would target all of the positions we're adding specifically to do that permitting work. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Your amendments, Andy, may reduce these numbers, but initially, based on the information I have in front of me from fiscal, you're going to make twice as much money off the fees as you're spending. More than twice.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Gerard, the fee is set, the fee level that we set was designed to cover us for three biennia. When you consider the roll-up costs, as staff explained in the previous testimony, the costs will increase. And the idea would be if we went up to 35 FTE today and increased the fee as proposed in the original bill, we would be needing another fee increase in the fourth biennium. But as I said, we will be phasing in the increase, so those amounts will be much lower in the final fiscal.
Paul, and then I think Paul wants to respond.
Paul, do you?
Yeah, you go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I was just going to mention Representative Gerard that part of the what you see is the cost you see is the cost to buy back the 1.5 positions that were eliminated because of the revenue shortfall. So then in 09-11, the next biennium, you would have the roll-up cost on the full 35 positions. So you would assume that it would be probably about the same, the $700,000, next biennium. And so as you go, it would be just about three biennia when you would get to the 21 or the even $2.1 million. Even at that cost, it would exceed what the revenue is in here. So it's because of, again, you're paying for the roll-up cost on the full 35 positions, not just what you see in the fiscal here. That doesn't sound like it was very clear.
Well, it sounds like it's similar to the bill we just heard, where it's like, yeah. Okay, Representative Gerard.
No, I have to digest what Paul just told me. It's like talking to your tax advisor.
Hopefully that is not as painful, though.
Hopefully my boss is
just telling me how much it's going to cost me.
Representative,
are those amendments around?
I'm sure Representative Clem. No, they're not. The LC's still working on them. We were hopeful we'd have at least a copy for you to look at before the meeting, but unfortunately they weren't done. So you will see. And when we do bring this bill back, then we would ask Andy to come back with some projections on the full cost of the program, assuming some inflation for all 35 positions, and then showing how that balance would be expended over time for the committee. Maybe that would provide some better information for you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Andy?
I'll just reserve my questions till we get the amendments and be able to see them.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Andy. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to call John Ledger and Donna Hippert. Thank you. If you can please state your name for the record.
You might go first. Vice Chair Dinkfelder and members of the subcommittee. My name is Donna Hippert, and I'm appearing before you this morning to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 107 as the bill was originally submitted. To give you a little background about myself, I've been working with Title V issues since shortly after I started law school in 1999 and commenting on various Title V permit renewals. And in fact, that I felt the Title V permit program was of enough importance that I traveled to San Francisco to testify before EPA's Title V task force that was convened. And so I continue working on these issues as a board member both of the Northwest Environmental Defense Center and Oregon Toxics Alliance, and also as a solo practice attorney specializing in air and toxics issues. Andy already went over the fact that the clean air mandates that Title V fees cover the Title V program, and that the department has been experiencing an underfunding and understaffed position for the past couple of years. I'm concerned that, as amended, the bill would allow DEQ to continue in this underfunded and understaffed position for at least a couple of more years. And, in fact, I'd go so far as to argue that DEQ, since it's been affected this way for the past few years, should actually overfund the program for a couple of years in order to be able to catch back up with the backlog that's accumulated. Over the past several years, the public interest sector in Oregon has become increasingly aware of and involved in these air quality issues. And although we've been aware of the shortcomings in the Title V program, we've put up with DEQ's level of funding with patience, knowing that they were going to propose full funding during this legislative session. So, as Andy said, that EPA is already concerned, and to allow DEQ to continue without adequate funding leaves them open to the removal of their Title V authority, and also to a petition, a legal challenge of the sort of the petition that's pending now on the agricultural air exemptions. If EPA finds a deficiency, I'd also like to point out that they could impose both discretionary and mandatory sanctions against Oregon. I feel like the funding as originally asked for by DEQ wasn't exorbitant. The fees and staffing is right in the middle of the spectrum, as Andy pointed out. And I also would like to express that I regret not having testified at the February public hearing. I guess I naively thought that since it was mandated by the Clean Air Act, this bill would pass without much opposition. And I didn't anticipate such resistance on the part of industry. I understand the concern of industry about the rising costs, but it could conversely be stated that they've been enjoying an unexpected bonus for the past couple of years and not having to pay fees that would adequately fund the program. And I don't think that there's been any evidence of hardship due to the fee increase given one way or the other. And also in the cost accounting, the fees to industry are really only one side of the equation. I would point out that the other side, and of equal importance, if not more importance, are the benefits realized by the public when pollution controls are implemented. There have been many EPA analyses of these costs and benefits done, and the benefits and costs of the Clean Air Act from 1970 to 1990 showed that the benefits outweighed the cost by a factor of 40 times over. And this is benefits both to health and the environment. A new report, a prospective report that's been prepared for Congress covering the 1990 to 2010 has a lower ratio. It's only four times, but it's still four times. The benefits still outweigh the costs of implementing the Clean Air Act by a factor of four. So I appreciate the desire of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee to achieve a consensus, and I believe that DEQ and industry worked hard to achieve this consensus, and I appreciate some of the provisions in the proposed amendment. I especially appreciate the provisions that were added to account for the expected dip in revenues in a few years. However, the Title V program is widely regarded as the key component of the Clean Air Act for public involvement, and the cost elements in the statute specifically address that the costs of the Title V program include public involvement and procedure. And so I feel like that achieving a consensus without involving the public interest sector is sort of like having a two-legged stool, that we weren't involved in coming to this consensus. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that the Clean Air Act is regarded as a public trust, and I ask you as the trustees to consider the public, your beneficiaries, and pass Senate Bill 107 as originally submitted. And I hope that whatever version of the bill the legislature ultimately passes, it does so with the assurance that adequate funding to implement the Title V program is restored to DEQ immediately. Thank you very much for your time.
Great, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Hibbett? Appreciate you coming here today, testifying. John?
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. And this is a topic that's kind of near to my heart. As some of you know, I actually had Andy's job when Cecil Anders was governor of Idaho. And we went through the same issues about how to fund this. Andy was kind enough to come up with a proposal of his own. What I did was I just told industry, we don't care. We just want the money. You guys fight it out amongst yourselves. And so we appreciate him coming forward with a proposal. I think a couple of things. As you know, industry has to pay for 100% of this program and all aspects of it. And also the fees are indexed to inflation. What you have heard is that the current staffing is about in the middle of the spectrum. So I don't see any chance of EPA withdrawing program authority from the agency whatsoever. However, it is very important to us that the DEQ be adequately staffed and competently staffed, and that is the impetus behind our agreement with DEQ on the amendments. It would take the increases and spread them out over 3 years, and they are not small increases. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars for some companies. Would spread it out over 3 years and also expand the base so at the end of that 3 years they're actually better off than under the current bill. What we don't want to see is something happening in 3 or 4 years where there's all of a sudden a big dip in staff because the emissions drop. They still have to regulate those sources. We think this is a reasonable plan. There are no constraints on what the EQC can do. It actually gets more information out there to the public and everybody else. I think it gives assurances to industry that when the EQC does go beyond federal, they've looked at all the issues. It doesn't require any type of findings or things that would be challenged in court. And this would just simply make it, I think, much more palatable to the regulated industries for such a hefty increase. We're looking at 24% on a fee that has been CPI'd over the years. I'd like to conclude by saying the air programs, I think, in this state are uniformly viewed as well-run and efficiently run. And frankly, one of the reasons when we had our air committee meeting, AOI air committee meeting, there everybody kind of bought into, you know, if the agency feels they need more staff, we take them at their word. They do a good job. What we'd like to see is just have it phased in over 3 years and the base corrected, so it just makes it a little more palatable to the people that pay the fee. None of this has anything to do with standards or actual air quality, because they're staffed now about the median, and this doesn't change any rules or regulations. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Ledger, I'm curious, because you did not mark down if you were in support of this bill or not. So if you could clarify that, and also with or without the amendments.
We are in support of it with the amendments. We would not be in support of it without the amendments.
Thank you. Early.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me, this question is a little... Well, it's more on the policy side of it, but it's because I'm totally ignorant of this whole program. And I'm curious, if I may ask, Madam Chair, on page 1, lines 6 and 7, and then on page 2, lines 5 through 11 and 17 through 19, it appears to me, and again, this is based on my ignorance of this program, so forgive me, but I mean, it seems to me we're deleting some rather substantive policy language here. What is it we're taking out?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I would actually prefer to have Andy address that, if he would. But I would say these fees and this program is mandated by federal law, and it's something that EPA has to see that's going to be there and in place.
We'll have Andy come up.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel?
Actually, when Andy comes back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So
actually,
just a quick one. Maybe Andy can answer when he comes up. Basically, air quality in both Oregon and Washington is very high, isn't it?
I think it depends on the area of the state. But, I can let Andy answer that.
I thought Oregon and Washington, particularly Washington, was received some sort of award for having the cleanest air, and Oregon is right behind them. We are doing a very good job here.
I think we can, Senator, until the Forest Service starts pouring up their lands.
If I might add very briefly, the industrial component of air pollution is very small from large industries. I don't know, it's 7% or 4% or something like that. And just as a side note, forest fires dwarf anything.
Right, the climate change presentation. All right, thank you very much. Actually, I'm going to call up the last panel, and then I'll have the department come back. If you're okay with holding your question, Representative Roth.
Sure. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Groner and Mr. Bauman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I represent the employees of DEQ. Mine will be short. This is a very important part of the Oregon Clean Air Initiative, which many of us has worked over a year. There are other bills coming in front of you that are an important part of the Oregon Clean Air Initiative. But as far as my members who work here, as far as morale, as far as monitoring and getting the job done, we appreciate you restoring, in the amendments we support, two of our three positions that we lost. I'd like to thank, this is twice in 2 days I've been able to do this. I worked with a large group on the Oregon Safe Cigarette Campaign, and Philip Morse worked with us, and now we have a law. The first state to work cooperatively with the industry, and now we're working with John Ledger once again to cooperatively and moderately resolve a very complex issue that doesn't allow states to put in general fund anyway, so it has to be funded Title V by fees. So we're very supportive of the amendment, of the amended Senate Bill 107. As far as my members and employees, we thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Ralph?
I have to ask Ralph a question.
Feel free.
You have apparently seen the amendment, which the committee hasn't.
Madam Chair, Honorable Representative Garrard, I have the probably luxurious opportunities of working very closely with someone you're going to hear from, Andy Ginsberg, and I have been briefed as we go along as to what the amendments do. I ask every day since 107 started in the process, where are we at? I asked John Ledger, where are we at? And then they would tell me. So the reason I know is because I constantly was, I don't want to use the word badgering, but bothering them somewhat. So that's
I can understand how you could do that to someone.
Yes, I could. Thank you.
Okay.
Badgering.
Jeremiah.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Bauman with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. I don't have to tell this committee, I assume, that clean air is of fundamental importance, not only for our state's natural beauty, when you look at the haze and visibility problems in the Columbia Gorge, but certainly for public health at a time when we've got rising incidence of childhood asthma, lung disease, and heart conditions that are all related in some ways to clean air. Senator Nelson is right. Oregon and Washington are blessed with, on average, better air quality than a lot of parts of this country. But there's certainly also a lot of parts of our state that don't necessarily have that good fortune all of the time. Parts of the Portland metro area, and in fact, areas statewide, have some of the worst toxic air pollution in the country, largely because of the way that our gasoline is formulated, mostly from vehicles. But then the Columbia Gorge faces increasing pollution problems from industrial and other sources. And parts of Lane County and the Rogue Valley also have constant ongoing air pollution problems that have to do with the combination of geologic and weather factors combining with some of the local pollution sources. This bill is, I think, incredibly important for two reasons. One, it deals with a very problematic permit backlog at DEQ. It does affect air quality in an important way because the Clean Air Act is designed to constantly renew the pollution permits so that those permits are go through scrutiny again to look at whether technology has evolved, whether operations have changed, whether there are ways to continuously reduce air pollution. Much the same way the Clean Water Act does that for air water quality permits with the goal of eventually getting to zero pollution. I should probably note the Clean Water Act had a goal of doing that by 1983, which wasn't quite met. There's one other important aspect to this bill, which is there's a good reason the Clean Air Act requires that the programs be fee-funded, and that is the principle of the polluter pays. It's both an economic principle and an environmental principle. From an economic perspective, it internalizes costs that just aren't accounted for in the costs of production because the costs of air pollution and public health are borne by all of society. And so having fees based on emissions helps internalize that in the economic sense. And then it also creates an incentive to reduce pollution, so it has a public health benefit as well. Osprey fully supports the SB 107, and we support the amendments as well, although I do want to voice one concern for Representative Guard's interest. I've also not seen any amendments yet, but I'm commenting on the summary of the amendments. Our concern is on the issue of allowing affected parties to request hearings on any proposal that would exceed federal standards for air quality. We don't have any significant objection to more information, certainly, and we think more public scrutiny and public hearings are always a good thing, so it certainly isn't with increased public scrutiny. It's simply with tying increased hurdles and slowing down of administrative processes specifically to Oregon's right to have our own air quality standards. Without states' ability to exceed federal environmental standards, there are all sorts of environmental programs that would never have happened. Oregon has, we initiated, led the country with cleaning up air pollution in common sense, cost-effective ways from wood heating stoves, recently reducing mercury pollution from one of the bigger sources in the state, the Boardman plant, and fundamentally are leading the national effort to curb global warming pollution with our standards for new cars and trucks sold. This is an important tool. In fact, the Federal Clean Air Act wouldn't exist if California hadn't adopted their own clean air laws because using their rights as a state. So our position is simply that we think DEQ and the Environmental Quality Commission, their process should be focused on the substance of the environmental problems they're looking at and what is the appropriate policy for the state to address our environment and maintain our environment and public health, not whether or not the federal government happens to agree with the citizens of Oregon what those standards should be. That said, we do support the bill and the amendments and urge the committee to act positively as soon as those amendments are ready.
Questions for Jeremiah? Jeremiah, I have one. Regarding, and I did have a question, and without the amendments in front of us, it's hard to comment on that policy, but as Andy described it, the question I had, and I can ask this to Andy as well, I'm just curious if we have a policy to have EQC review any other rules in the way that these amendments would be making that change.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that currently in rule but not in statute, the Environmental Quality Commission agrees to disclose in a notice of proposed rulemaking, disclose whether a standard exceeds federal and what the rationale for exceeding the federal standard is. My understanding of the proposed amendments is that this would put that into statute and provide an additional right for an affected party to request a hearing in front of the Environmental Quality Commission, whenever that is the case.
And follow up to that, so they currently don't have that ability?
That is my understanding.
Okay, and I can ask Andy to clarify that, except coming in front of the EQC during the public comment period for their regular meetings. I mean, that's a question I need clarification. So
that's, and then specifically, I think there's also a sort of a separate track going on because the Environmental Quality Commission is doing a very good job of increasing their engagement with the public during rulemaking processes. So historically, the DEQ staff hold the hearings and collect public comment and then present that to the commission. The commission itself historically has not taken very much direct public comment on a lot of proposed rules. They're in the process of changing that. And so this fits, I think, with that trend towards increased public engagement with the commission itself, as Mr. Ginsburg noted. And certainly that's, I think, a positive direction for rulemaking procedures at the agency.
Hey, I'm going to have the department quickly come up because we have to be on the floor in 5 minutes. If you could address some of the questions that were raised, both Representative Burley, I think, aren't we on the floor at 10?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
but
I'm shrugging my shoulders and I don't know why.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, Andy Ginsberg with the Department of Environmental Quality. Representative Garrard asked about the sections that were deleted. Mm-hmm. On page 1, lines 6 and 7, that language was because when we originally adopted the Title V program, EPA had not yet approved it, so these fees didn't go into effect. And even though they were adopted in 1991, they didn't go into effect until 1994. So now that's all past history. This is just cleanup.
Madam Chair, I believe these will represent Burley's questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right.
Sorry about that.
So just to follow up on that, is it the same on page 2 as well as I was reading through this? It just seemed like it was initial.
There was an interim fee during the startup period that this is being repealed.
Okay. Okay. And then I think Representative Klein had a question, and then maybe you can address the EQC issue I raised.
Well, and it's possible, actually, my question is related to yours. I'm just looking at line 37 and 38 on page 2 of the commission shall establish by rule the size fraction of total particulates subject to emission fee rule. So I see that we're increasing fees, and I guess what I'm trying to understand is are we changing policy as well in this bill to allow for additional either restrictions, but really more fee allowances to things that are more, I assume, going smaller, fine particulates. I don't really know, but that's what I'm trying to understand that change.
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, if you look on line 17 and 18, you'll see that we refer to PM10, and at the time this bill was adopted, we were undergoing a lot of change on the federal level of what size fraction of particulate they were regulating. They used to regulate all particulate, total suspended particulate, and then they started only regulating particulate that was 10 microns in diameter and smaller, and then subsequent to that, 2.5 microns in diameter and smaller. And so when this bill was adopted, we weren't sure exactly what the regulated pollutant was going to be. It's still a complicated scenario. EPA tried recently to revise the standard to eliminate the PM10 requirement, and they ended up keeping it. So we still have two different size fractions. We don't want a permittee to have to pay twice on the same emissions. This is the bottom line. So because we can't really anticipate how EPA is going to change the rule, lines 37 and 38 allow the commission to address that as we go. So basically, we'll just ensure that a company only pays once on the same emissions. That's what that's about. This doesn't affect any regulation of those emissions, just what fees they pay.
Follow on, and then Representative Burley.
So I can be somewhat assured that if something is currently not subject to this because it's more fine, I don't know if that's the right word or not, that this section is not going to bring them into paying fees on it than what we're currently doing?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, the requirement is for anything that's 2.5 microns and smaller, so it already includes everything or 10 microns and smaller, and you can see there's an overlap. The 10 microns and smaller includes the 2.5 microns and smaller, and so that's why you've got this problem of double counting that we have to address.
Other direction then. I mean, I've heard things about field burning versus wood stoves, you know, smoke home-based wood stoves, and that one of them's more fine than the other. I don't remember which way, but I'm just trying to figure out it. Make sure we're not going to start, for example, if wood stoves were over PM10, are we going to end up now through this bill charging emission fees through things that are larger than, you know, currently we do?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, this fee only applies to major emission sources that have 100 tons of emissions per year or more, so a wood stove could never be subject to it.
It's got a big wood stove.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Andy, though, and I appreciate your explanation, because then apparently, if I understand, the reason 17, 18, and 19 are being taken out is because 37, 38 is being added.
Correct.
Okay. Does 37, 38 allow the commission to in essence set standards that are tougher than what EPA is?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, no, it just has, all it does is describe what size fraction is subject to the fee. So it doesn't change at all the requirement for reducing emissions or meeting emission standards. It just defines which size fraction will be subject to the fee.
Follow up. Did I understand you to say that EPA sets whether it's PM10 or PM2.5, and then we just adopt that by rule? That's what this is doing. But would this allow the commission to adopt a different size than what EPA has set?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, this doesn't have to do with adopting the standard. The commission does that under different legislative authority. This just has to do with the fee. So what this allows the commission to do would be, for example, they could say that the fee will be charged on PM10 emissions and we won't charge any fees on PM2.5 emissions because of the overlap. Or if someday EPA eliminates the PM10 standard, we may only charge the fee on PM2.5. It doesn't have anything at all to do with the regulatory requirements or bringing new emissions under regulation or anything like that. It's just designed to avoid double counting of the fee. Sorry, am I not being clear?
Well, it's just, yeah, you're not, because if EPA says charge the fees on PM10, this would allow our commission to say, well, okay, but we're going to do it on PM something else. We can do something else. This doesn't say that we have to charge the fee based on what EPA says.
I see. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, EPA doesn't prescribe what the fee should be charged on. They don't even require us to charge it on emissions. There is a default in the Clean Air Act that says that recommends an emission fee, but some states charge the fee based on a totally different basis, and you'll see most states have an emission fee or a combination of emission fee and base fee like we do, but there's no requirement to charge the fee in a certain way.
Just for clarification, that EPA sets standard and we set the fees and the fee schedule or however we're going to recover the cost of the program.
I'm sure that's correct.
Okay. One last question and then I'm going to adjourn. Or we can have... Oh, did you have a question, too?
We have Mike's thermal guidance.
Okay. No, is there why it's for this section as well?
We're fine with the entire package.
Senator?
Does Mount St. Helen included in this package, too?
If it drifts over into Oregon, then I think so. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 107, close the Subcommittee on Ways and Means, and on Monday we will start DEQ's budget.